Thank you for tuning in to Healing Race. In this episode, our four guests continue to discuss how their upbringings shape their views about race. Marin and Marcus share what they learned as Black Americans growing up about what it means to be Black or white in our country. The conversation touches on the role of race in standards of beauty and how we see or don't see ourselves represented in books and media and in what it takes to succeed in this country.
What kind of effect can race have on how we see ourselves, who we want to be, and what others expect us to be as we grow up? This conversation opens up an emotional window into the ways race can seep into our upbringings, and it provided a chance for our guests to find some common experiences and outlooks, while also showing that having the same racial identity does not always mean that you have the same kind of life experiences. So let's get to that conversation now. Enjoy. Question, Marcus and Marin, would be like, what did you learn about white people growing up? What were their learnings that you had? Because I guess we
didn't. And my question for Marin is, what did you learn about white women?
I asked a hard question. It was more like lessons I took in, like very rarely explicit things. Mm-hmm. Like very rarely were there explicit things said. It was just messages I took in from around me. I learned, for example, like white women were just like the ideal. They were the ideal in beauty. They were the ideal in femininity. They were, you know, the ideal that like every man wanted one. And that honestly, like if a Black man were good enough, you would know he was good enough because he got a white woman. That sort of thing. And so I do remember, you know, being young and I mean, while I have braids now, I relaxed my hair straight. There were times like I remember like I would like pretend to toss my hair and walk and act like a white woman thinking mm-hmm. that's going to make boys like me. Mm-hmm. And things like that. I don't know if y'all ever seen the movie Precious, but there's a part in the movie where she's looking in the mirror and she's daydreaming about being white. I can relate to that. And I cried in the theater because I remember doing that when I was really young. So it was like, you know, and, you know, like while we were kids, you just remember like junior high and high school where there was always like homecoming queen and prettiest and all of that. And they were all certain looking white women. So that was kind of, you know, what I took in. And even, you know, back when I was like a young girl, I mean, pay attention to like books I read and things like that. I mean, it was Sweet Valley High. It was Nancy Drew. It was, you know, there just was not, you know, a lot. I mean, I look at the books that youth today get to read and I was like, there was none of this.
And how did you evolve emotionally given all of that messaging that was coming in?
Well, my time at Stanford was really, really big for me because honestly, where I began to, I don't want to say break from white people, but I mean, most of my closest friends and in my closest circle growing up, I mean, were white kids, my classmates, my neighbors, everything. But it was my senior year in high school when college acceptances started coming in that the same people I had grown up with since sixth grade or before, it was Stanford only took you because you're Black. My parents told me that, you know, if you and I both apply to that school, they have to take you over me. And I was sitting there, I was like, these are people I tutored, you know, when they were close to like flunking chemistry and things like that. And to turn around and say things like that to me, it was very much like, okay, like we were not the friends that I thought we were. And when I got to college, I really began to explore who I am as a Black woman, a young Black woman. I began to grow out my relaxed hair. I began to take African-American studies classes. While the Black community at Stanford wasn't big, it was big to me. Like 600 Black students on one campus, you know, in the grand scheme of a university is not a lot, but that was a lot to me. And I threw myself in it. And like most of my friends from Stanford are other Black people. And it was also interesting seeing the reaction that my white friends from home had to that. It definitely turned into a, this is not the Marin that I know and I grew up with. You're just so black now. Mm-hmm. I would be told that, and I'd be like, huh? I've always been black. But there was something that was making them uncomfortable about the journey that I was taking. And a lot of that involves me confronting some of the negative things I learned, again, directly or indirectly, about Black people. Being in the Black upper middle class or upper class, there can be a lot of the whole, like, almost respectability politics thing going on, where we fight really hard to prove we're not like the Black people that white people hate or are talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to prove we speak proper English, we are educated, we work hard, we're not the ghetto people. And so we'll kind of turn on one another that way. And so I didn't realize how much I had internalized that, growing up. So my time at university was really interesting to me, you know, through my friendship with people like Andre, who grew up very different from me, because the few Black people who were around me, you know, were the children of my parents' friends. So they were also children of doctors and lawyers and things like that. So I hope that answers some of the question. There was a lot.
It does.
Yeah. Any thoughts or questions about what Marin said? And I'd love to hear, Marcus, as well, what you're...
Marin, you hurt my heart when you were talking about being a little girl and thinking that a white girl was, or white woman was, the ideal. That just hurts. That really pains me.
Oh, thanks so much, Susan. You know, it's one of the things that I'm very sensitive to this day. I mean, while standards of beauty are definitely really evolving, like, I pay attention to sometimes things that I view as being somewhat performative. For example, a few years ago, the actress Lupita Nyong'o was named the most beautiful woman in the world. You know, she got the cover of People magazine, right? And she's this dark-skinned African-Mexican actress, you know, with natural hair, everything of that sort. Okay, great. Lupita is stunning. But I remember saying to Andre, I'll believe that the world believes this when she gets the romantic lead role across from George Clooney. Mm-hmm. She's not going to get it. So this was just a woo-ha, see? Like, we think one dark-skinned girl with an afro is cute. But, like, you're not going to tell me that she is viewed as beautiful until she is competing with Jennifer Aniston for the leading man's heart in a movie. Until then, it's just, like, kind of the same thing.
And that seems to connect a little bit with the way people question you being at Stanford as well, right? There's an idea that anyone who would get in is kind of performative in some way, right? It's not based on the merits in some way, that there maybe can't be that excellence in the Black community in some way. It's all performative. So
I was told I was lying when I told people I was a graduate of the university.
Yeah.
They said, you're lying. And I said, who would lie about that? You can just call the school and they'll tell you.
I mean, it's very interesting too. Like, I don't want to veer us to, of course, but when it comes to race and kind of colleges and elite colleges or whatever, and I know I've shared this with Andre before too, I've said, you know, while we have known, you know, that there's been kind of a game to admissions to these universities for generations, I said, what I'm careful about is, you know, when these universities were very, very white, I'll use Stanford as an example. Go look at any Stanford graduating class from before like 1981. Like, when they started making their focus on diversity, and it was extremely white. And it's interesting because back then it was like, oh my gosh, to go to Stanford, like, you must be smart, you must be brilliant, it's so amazing, blah, 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 like all of this. And now that, you know, a university like Stanford is predominantly non-white, especially with the Asian population and like everything of that sort, now I've noticed the national dialogue is, that's elitist, whatever, it's nothing to go to that school, you're trying to take it away from these kids, like, who are like, I was like, no, it's still the same. I mean, I told myself I couldn't get into Stanford today. I look at the application, some of these kids going today, and I'm like, whoo, it's gotten that much more competitive. You know, yes, well, there are things to talk about. Let's not take it away from these kids of all different races and colors who are getting in. Because I do think part of that is rooted in, well, when it was merit-based, it was all white. Again, kind of undertones there.
We'll get to some of that conversation. I just want to give Marcus a chance to share a little bit of his background before we move to Landon's question, because Landon, you kind of started to veer us there in terms of your background and how it related to history and how you viewed history. And I know you have a question about that. Marcus, what did you learn when it came to, let's say, white people? What was the messaging?
I will actually tie what I learned about Black people and white people all together. So okay. I didn't grow up in the sense of, again, thinking that I was less than. I guess I would say one of my earliest memories would be the idea that you have to be twice as good to get half of what they have. And we kind of talked about this before, but it was more so a sense of, don't leave this house and embarrass me. Act like you have some home training. Just keeping a level head and being cognizant that, again, you're not going to get extended the same grace that others may be extended or given. And like, you just have to know who you are. It's not to say that you're less than, but you have to know who you are and know your place. And so with that said, even to this day, some of my best friends are white. Some of the friends that I made in college, friends that I still have from back home growing up. So I've never really felt that I was less than they were or that they were better. I've never been presented with the idea or the assumption that I'm less than or they're better than me. It was just, you have to know your place and your role.
And I get that. Like, you were mindful that your family taught you have different constraints.
Yes. And I didn't grow up in a divided home. My mom and dad were married for 29 years. My mom passed away when I was 14 from throat cancer. So I didn't grow up thinking that the Cosby Show was a fictitious dream or that that's not the ideal Black family. Like, that was my reality. My dad was there. He was present. And the whole time that my mom was sick, like, he was a stand-up guy. Like, he was there. So that just wasn't my experience. And so, not to discredit the experience that others may have, but you just have to know, like, and be cognizant and remind yourself of your own reality and truth, if that makes sense.
So you didn't learn anything about who you were as a Black person vis-a-vis white people or white people, you know, you didn't learn anything about the comparison, one being better or not, or worse.
I won't say that I didn't learn it, but it wasn't an everyday topic. Kind of just unspoken.
I see. What was the premise? What's the premise of the twice as good to get half as much? Like, is it because this is, you know, was the communication like, this is the society we live in? So you have to be twice as good to get half as much. And so what is the society we live in? The society that we live in does what that forces you to need to be twice as good and to get half as much? Like, what was communicated about the society you live in?
Just that you're not going to be extended the same grace that white people may be given, or you're not going to get away with this. So to bring it in concept, I'm a cop. I never thought that I would leave my home and be a victim of police brutality. It was more so, you can't go out, you can't do this, don't do that, act like you have home training, don't embarrass me. And I just knew that if I went out and I did those things, that I wasn't going to be extended that grace.
May I add another thing that can add context to that? Barack Obama, perfect example. Like, the scrutiny when he was running for office or made office, like, no one, and same things with Ketanji in the Supreme Court, like, they were asking for her LSAT scores. They didn't do that for white candidates. You know, like, they were asking for, like, I want Barack Obama's transcripts and proof that he went to these schools. They don't do that for white candidates. It's just birth certificate. There will be extra scrutiny on like, how did you get here? Because you were not supposed to be here. That happens. Even, you know, when you say twice as good to get half as much, I mean, you can look at the Obamas now, but when he was running for office, they were still paying off their student loans. Behind they were in terms of things. Yeah. But yes, people were still like, how are they getting this money? And going to, in a way that they just don't ask or challenge white people. And that is when there's this, you have to be that much more impeccable. Because one little speck, one, you know, C plus on his Harvard transcript, it's done. It's
he's an idiot.
Like, you're going down. Like,
you're done.
The way it is.
And also to say, the man wore a tan suit and it was a whole headline. A tan suit. I was like,
well, and well, for women, we're all, they always comment on what we wear no matter what. So right. You got a taste of that.
Exactly. Landon and Susan, when you hear these stories, like, what are your thoughts? Like, how does it sit with you, or what questions do you have? About what that experience is like.
Yeah, right. I mean, I've heard this, you know, these events. My experience is, you know, I came from a pretty poor background, and I went, you know, if you look up my high school on the high school rankings, it's 1 out of 10, you know. And so I didn't have a great educational head start, you know. So but I had this curiosity that came to me when I was around 22, and I went to college, and I was just incredibly fascinated that this all existed, and I really hadn't known about it, you know. But this was 25 years ago, and at the time, you know, in the last 20 years, there has been a push for diversity in colleges, and I was part of that. And I always thought that this is a good thing, you know. And so I was proud to be part of it. I didn't resent it, but I saw that it was happening. You know, these colleges, these laboratories, these companies, they want to hire people with different skin color. They really do. And especially Black people, they really do. And that goes on today. And so I never felt like that was a bad thing. I thought this was, you know, what we had to do. And yet, when I hear about it today, nobody really wants to talk about that, you know, like, because it hasn't actually come to pass that the diversity has gotten to the point that everybody, that people are satisfied with. But I know from my experience that there's been a lot of us who wanted this diversity to happen and still want it to happen. So I think that that gets kind of left out of the conversation.
And that's a good point. When I earlier I said assuming things, and what you just said, there are a lot of us that want this diversity to happen, right? And when you hear the things, like, for example, that Marin and Marcus have shared, it, for me, because I'm very interested in the emotionality of all of this, and for me it's like, okay, well, they don't want diversity, and so any diversity that we may see is just placation. And that's why we have some, depending on your point of view, such slow growth in diversity. But it's good, I mean, number one, by saying that you're establishing yourself as an ally for racial diversity, and you challenge my assumption that just white, particularly white men, just don't want us around.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, when Marin, you talk about the people who scrutinize in the Black community and people who come out of there to take the place in the Supreme Court, you know, I think that that's a small, well, not small, but there's a subset of our country that definitely does that. But I don't think that they're anywhere near a majority. In fact, I think majority is either neutral or wants to see progress in diversity, you know. However, there's the political divide. This is so wrapped up in politics at this point, right? That it's hard to untangle the politics, which I think is the most powerful identity in the United States right now, is political identity. And I think it even is more powerful than racial identity at this point in some respects.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Yeah.
What does it feel like, Marcus, to I don't know. I'm trying to imagine if my parents told me I had to be work twice as hard to be half as good. It's not that they didn't put any parameters of the kind of values and character that they wanted to see in me, but I certainly didn't. That's not messaging that I heard when I, in terms of how I, you know, experience going out into society. What is that? What is that like to feel that, to hear that messaging, to feel that messaging on whatever basis, regular basis there it was during your.
And I have a more specific question. Did you ever come to resent your friends?
What friends?
The white friends.
No, I never came to resent any of my friends, because even the level of success that they achieved, I achieved the same or more. So I never resented them for anything. As far as what did it feel like to be taught you have to work twice as hard to get half of what they have, I don't really think it felt like anything. It was normal.
Just normal.
It was just an understanding. Like, it is what it is. So I don't know how to articulate a specific feeling that it gave me.
Yeah.
It was just more so, this is reality, and you're not going to be extended the same grace that they are, and this is what you have to do. If you,
you never felt resentment around that? Mm-mm.
I would say that's the same thing for me. I can't think of any resentful feelings, at least not like, none of that was, and even now, I mean, even though
I resent it
to a certain extent, I've seen it play out in terms of, I graduated top of my class. That was drama. I mean, literally there were white parents who went and demanded to see my transcripts and things like that, which are private. you know, all of that. I mean, it was a very, very like huge deal at my school. But I would say, you know, now going back, I went to what, my 25-year reunion, like right after we could associate after COVID. And yeah, well, I was top of my class and I went to Stanford, Ebola. I mean, my classmates who did not inherited a lot. I'm talking about like board seats at Haynes and things like that, where I was just like, this is a bit of what my parents were talking about. Because some of y'all were the C students that I was tutoring, and like, kind of the, I worked twice as hard and definitely got half as much, because they are sitting very, very pretty in terms of businesses handed to them, you know, millions of dollars in funding handed to them, you know, from, you know, relatives or, you know, networks that their parents had and things like that, were like, you know, I'm a starter from the bottom, now I'm here.
Yeah.
And that reparations.
Yeah, we'll get to reparations. I know you got that question, Marcus.
But I have another question. And sorry to kind of take over. Like I said, I'm interested in the emotion.
Yeah. You know, just to share, I haven't been sharing that much because I wanted to be more about you. But, you know, Mary, when you described what you just described, I saw the same thing in my community. And I grew up with an idea that we are in a meritocracy, that, you know, we have opportunity. You know, I know it's not equal, but the idea that we should all have opportunity, and then you work hard to achieve whatever you're going to achieve in life. And I come from a very affluent area. You know, at 10 years old, we moved to Beverly Hills, right? So like the symbol, right, of affluence in the pop culture. And it was hard for me to see people who, like you said, Marin, did not apply themselves in their lives up through their 20s, but then just got stuff handed to them. And, you know, there's part of me that says, well, listen, you know, I don't know, maybe their parents really strived hard and they wanted to give to their kids, right? And to give them that opportunity. You know, part of what we do as parents is we strive to be able to provide for our kids, so that in some ways it is easier, or they do have more opportunity than we had. But at the same time, there was a feeling of like, I know these kids, like I know what they did for most of their time during their teens and 20s. And I know people who worked really hard, whatever color they may be, you know, skin color, who were not afforded the same kind of opportunities to thrive in life. So I just wanted to share a kind of, you know, that I relate actually to what you said. It got at my heart and my soul a little bit, because of the narrative that I grew up with about about the United States and about how, how one needs to live one's life. Landa, do you, you know, you just made a mention about, you know, I don't know if you said that you were actually part of the diversity, like was it diversity in terms of geographic diversity going to college? Or you were just saying you went to college during a time when diversity was a push.
Yeah.
Like, were you in an area that where a lot of people went to college? And I don't know, do you relate at all to the some of the themes that Marcus and Marin shared, given where you grew up from? I'm curious about it.
Yeah, I mean, I really relate on a class level to what both of you shared, because I also resented rich white people.
Thank you. Thank you for stating that, Landon. Thank you for stating that.
Yeah, and I still do.
It's okay to some degree.
You still do. There's a little bit in your heart. Yeah. And how did they view you? Well, tell me more, but I also want to know, how did you think they viewed you? Or did you know, did you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I didn't have a great education going up through high school. It was just, that wasn't a big focus on our community. You know, it wasn't cool to be a nerd or even a good student. Like, most of us did not want to be that. So that was the values of the place where I grew up. But, you know, even today, you know, I went to college from 2000 to, I got an undergrad degree. I got a PhD, and then I did postdoctoral work for 5 years. And in this time, we raised a family of four kids, my wife and I. And I can tell you, we were below the poverty line for 16 years in a row. Mm-hmm. And I didn't resent that. I felt like it was the most educational thing I could do for my kids. So I have this very different mindset about what education comprises for kids. And it was never that mommy and daddy are gonna grease the tracks for you so you can get a great start in life. It's that we're gonna teach you the values that were required for success, but we're not gonna give you, we're not gonna pay for, you know, give you a full ride to college and pay for everything for you. You're gonna learn the values that are required so that you can go out in the world as an adult and have success. And part of that is just that you have to work and be patient, and you also will have to be poor for a period of time, at least, while you try to realize who you are and what goals you want to accomplish in your life. And if you don't have goals that are academic, that's okay, you know? But, you know, that was always the focus in my family. That was the values that I grew up with. I still don't like it when we pass down generational wealth to the children when they have not had the opportunity to realize themselves yet, you know? I don't think that's good for American society at all. And because I just think it's a major lack of education for the kids when that happens to them. They don't know what it's like to be in, you know, in the poor people's shoes or how they are able to succeed. So that's my experience, resenting white people who are rich and gave their kids everything. I still have a difficult time with that, honestly.
I share that a lot.
I just want to say something too. I could resonate being a female in the tech industry for, you know, my whole career, and we're having to work a lot, not twice as hard for half as much, but certainly having to go a step farther almost every time, and still being overlooked. I mean, and it not even just feeling invisible,
right?
And passed over, and you know,
So I will say that I don't know anyone personally that I grew up with or went to school with or college with that I resent, but I do resent rich white people. I do. I do. And why? I have a particular problem with paying more in taxes than a millionaire. That just bothers me to my core. Ugh, that just, ugh. So, yes.
Yeah.
I just, before we transition, and Andre, if you can transition us to Landon's question, but I just wanted
to,
Marcus, the reason I asked you that question earlier and you too, Marin, is I don't know. It just felt like, and maybe you just don't know different. You don't get to live a second life to know something to compare it to. But, you know, if I were messaged that twice as good to get half as much, and maybe I got it a little bit from my grandparents coming, you know, who came over as Jews from the Holocaust and, you know, emblemize, you know, we're the epitome of that kind of an ethos. It just feels like a lot of pressure. If I had to walk out, you know, of my house every day and feel like I'm not going to get grace and I have to be twice as good to get half as much. It just felt to me in my being, when I heard that, it just felt like a lot of pressure. So, yeah. You know, but I understand not knowing a different life. Yeah.
It's not just the twice as good to be half as much. It is the pressure of, if you mess up, they're not going to give another person who looks like you a shot. And Susan, I see you nodding your head. That could be the same thing for women. That can be, you know, the same, definitely a thing for, you know, as a Black person, it's like a all eyes on you. Mm. And the moment that you don't hit quarterly profits, or the moment that, you know, you make that, you know, honest mistake, it's a, see, you know, we shouldn't have, you know, put a woman in this position, or see, this is what happens when we focus on diversity, or, right. You know, whatever kind of the negative messaging is there.
So if you feel the pressure, not just for your personal aspirations, but you feel the pressure as a representative of a community who's coming, who's going to have a shot at that potentially in the future. That's what you're, is that what you're?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Andre, you were about to say something.
Yes. thank you, Todd. Well, I was about to say, so, you know, like I said, I'm interested in the emotionality of all of this. And we talk about pressure and everything that you guys have shared. And that's why your home environment is really important in having that support. And what I was going to say, two things, is think of having that pressure and your mother is trying to raise two children, younger children. So for me, I had to internalize a lot of that. And just like, I mean, you want to know what I learned about Black people? I learned I have to rely on myself, flat out, full stop. And you'll have to talk to my mother about the story, but she'll corroborate it, the things that I've achieved in my life. That's number one. And then number two, yeah, I would say one of the most intimate things that we all experience, entertainment, is completely emblematic of, you know, having to carry the weight of the collective on your shoulders. I mean, to me, it seems like we have more movies being directed by women than ever in Hollywood now. And I was reading an article about, you know, the pressure it was under for Patty Jenkins to get Wonder Woman right. And not only from that, to have a sequel that was done from Wonder Woman, right? And it just made me think that, you know, whether you like it or not, you are put in the life circumstances you're put in, and you just have to deal with it. And maybe that's me talking about the whole rely on yourself, but I just want the world to know that that is stressful. It really is. And then when you slow down after you've gotten to some level of success, for me, that's when all the emotions of it, and that's why I use the word resent, the emotions of it start hitting home. And you're like, wait, because when you hear about the easier time that other people had, and you're like, I had to do all of that just to arrive in the same place or to achieve more, like, to me, there's no other word for it, resent.
I
kind of understand that, Andre. I just never viewed it in that light, and maybe that's one of the advantages of my background, you know. I felt like I wanted to go on a journey, and it was a journey of self-discovery, you know. I didn't really care how long it took, and I thought that if I have my kids and we go on this journey together, then this is a journey of self-discovery for all of us. They're going to see how we're poor. Like, we never made more than $30,000 a year. There were six of us in a single three-bedroom apartment unit. And, you know, I thought that this was true education for our kids. And, you know, so I kind of relished that opportunity, and until I... Yeah, after a while, yeah, it started to get old.
And I connect with that. And I'll tell you why, because I'm just going to be explicit. I was thinking about the backgrounds of Merritt and Todd. I really was. And feelings of resentment came up. And then I thought to myself, I said, you know what, Andre, that if you had to choose it all again, I would do it no differently, because I liked the person that it made me. Yeah. I liked who I became out of all of that.
Thank you for watching this episode of Healing Race, and stay with us for a scene from our next video.
If you want to see more conversations like the one you just watched, please subscribe to our channel, share this video with friends and family, and like and comment on the video below.
If you'd like to be a guest on one of our episodes and have an open, real conversation about race, email us at guests@healingraceshow.com.
And if there are topics you think we should cover, we'd love to hear them. So please email your ideas to topics@healingraceshow.com.
As always, thanks for your support. We look forward to continuing the conversation with you. Now, here's a scene from our next Healing Race.
I kind of mentioned what, you know, the idealized history looked like for a person in a typical conservative area, I would say. And I wanted to know, you know, how do you guys view United States history? You know, there's, you know, some people are really bitter about it. Some people just have this religious viewpoint that it's straight from God's hand. And then there's all the mess in between. And so how do you think about it? And where do you draw strength from your history, your story, and what values and character came out of it?
I also am very wary when people talk about, particularly Black people, and the victimhood narrative and everything like that. And I say, no. I was like, well, we are descendants of slaves. We are not victims. We are victors. You know, if anything, I look back on the fact that, you know, 7-8 generations ago, my family was bought off the coast of Houston to be where we are today and to have survived Jim Crow. And my family, we have a lot of sort of, I mean, my uncle accidentally drinking out of like a whites only fountain, and my great grandfather having to sit up with a shotgun waiting for the Klan. Like those sorts of stories to come to like where we are is one of unbelievable triumph, unbelievable pride, unbelievable faith.